Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Joel Pruess with the University of Dayton will talk about a global event taking place right here in the Miami Valley. And WISO's Juliet Fromholt talks with photographer Jennifer Clark about an upcoming exhibit featuring her work. Up first, Dayton Children's Hospital and Public Health Dayton and Montgomery County both hosted events this past week centered around Ohio's high infant mortality rate. Ohio has one of the highest rates of infant deaths in the country, and health officials and politicians alike want that to change. During a two-hour session at Children's Hospital Thursday, about 40 healthcare professionals and state legislators discussed some of the reasons for high infant death rates in the state. Elaine Markland, a nurse at Children's, reported that the hospital looked at 24 infant deaths recorded by the hospital's emergency room and found that at least 9 of those infants had suffocated.
We did find that 7 out of the 9 had had prior contact with Children's, either in our outpatient testing centers, but also in our emergency department and in other areas.
Children's now sees those cases as missed opportunities to educate parents about keeping their newborns safe while they sleep, so they have a plan. Anne Marie Schmearsall serves on the Infant Mortality Awareness and Prevention Committee with Elaine Markland. She says the hospital's education plan starts close to home.
We have about 1,800 employees here, and about 50% of our staff are of childbearing age. So not only are we impacting our staff to practice safe sleep in their home, but they also serve as the mentors for their family and friends in the community.
State Senator Shannon Jones has spearheaded the infant mortality discussions around the state and says Ohio has a lot to be proud of when it comes to its health care resources, but the number of infant deaths has to become a priority.
We can't be as proud as we should be of these great research and medical facilities if we aren't treating our people the way that we should be.
The Infant Mortality Forums will move to its final stop in Cleveland next week. In this week's Politics Ohio, several looming deadlines are at the center of much debate in Washington. On October 1st, Americans without insurance will need to start shopping for health care through new exchanges that have been set up. We're also moving closer to another budget deadline. The president and fellow Democrats want an increase in the debt ceiling, while Republicans are once again challenging that. But Republicans aren't unified in this fight, and it's caused some challenging moments for Speaker of the House John Boehner. To talk about those challenges and where things stand today, I'm speaking with Jack Torrey, Washington Bureau Chief with the Columbus Dispatch and Dayton Daily News. Jack, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So give us the latest on Speaker Boehner's leadership. He appears to have made some efforts to unify Republicans recently when he agreed to put forward a resolution to continue funding the government, but not Obamacare. Has that, in fact, unified the party?
Only in a very superficial way. The Republican Party is deeply split right now between, I guess you could call it its moderate wing, although there are very few moderates left in the House Republican caucus, the wing of the party that wants to govern and the wing of the party that simply is here to oppose. And it's very difficult to unite them all on one particular stance. And on this one, there's a deep, deep division, because a number of the more conservative members want to make it impossible for the 2010 health care law, which has been known as Obamacare, to go into effect. There's simply no way that can happen. Even if the House passes a bill to stick with that position, and it's passed one already, the Senate will never go along with it. The president will veto it, and the government will simply run out of money at midnight on Monday, and there will be a partial shutdown.
The New York Times reported that some Republicans were trying to round up votes from the rank and file by agreeing to an increase in the debt limit to avert the mid-October default, but only if Democrats delayed the individual mandate on health coverage for another year. Has this unified the Republicans any further, and what are Democrats saying about the offer?
Democrats hate the offer, and it really hasn't unified the Republicans. The Republicans thought, well, we'll put this big goodie bag together and put all of our the things we really like in there, like the Keystone Pipeline, a delay in Obamacare for a year, and that sort of thing. And they thought they could round up enough votes to pass it out of the House. Well, as of last night, Thursday night, that did not appear to be the case. And I have to tell you, I think there's a number of House Republicans who won't vote for an increase in the debt ceiling under any circumstances. And the reason being is that the congressional districts, and you see that in Ohio, are drawn to favor conservative candidates. And so your biggest fear is to be challenged by another conservative in a primary rather than a general election. Representative Jim Jordan, for example, there's no way he can lose a general election race. But it's in theory, it's possible for him to be challenged by another conservative in the primary and defeated there. So as a result, a number of these people just won't vote for an increase in the debt ceiling. Having said that, eventually the government will raise the debt ceiling. It always does. And anybody, a lawmaker who is foolish enough to take part in what could be a default will instantly regret it because voters will be really angry.
What impact could that have for communities in Southwest Ohio and people affiliated with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base?
The military base will stay open because the government, the Department of Defense, the administration has the ability to declare what's essential operations for the government. So they're not going to shut down the military. If you planned on going to the Air Force Museum out of Wright-Patterson, that will probably close until the government reopens. If you're a civilian worker at Wright-Patterson, you face a possibility of another furlough, and they've already had one round of furloughs there. But that's if this lasts a long time. The history of this type of thing, and our most recent history on this is 1996, is within a week or two, pressure builds to do something.
The vote is expected Sunday. What will happen in the next few days, or what's the next story after that?
Well, I think what you're going to see is sort of a ping-pong match here. The House is going to pass its version of a temporary spending bill, attaching a bunch of conditions to it that the Senate won't accept. The Senate will then pass what's called a clean temporary spending bill. The official name is a continuing resolution. They'll go back and forth and back and forth, and then sometime on Monday night, somebody's going to have to blink, or the government will have a partial shutdown.
I've been speaking with Jack Torrey, Washington Bureau Chief with the Columbus Dispatch and the Dayton Daily News. Jack, thanks for speaking with us.
Glad to be with you.
Meanwhile, the federal government is scrambling to get ready for the launch of the Marketplace, where the uninsured will shop for health plans. Open enrollment for Obamacare plans begin October 1st, and lots of people are still confused about what it all means. As WISO's Lewis Wallace reports, in Ohio, insurers themselves are going to play a major role in explaining the new law.
There are 1.5 million people in Ohio without health insurance, and most will be required to get it starting in 2014. But there are just a few dozen official navigators working to educate Ohioans about these new health plans. So insurance companies, like CareSource, are stepping up their game. Scott Streeter with CareSource says step one will just be getting people who are uninsured used to the idea of going out and buying insurance.
They have been turned down by insurance companies for years. They have been priced out of the market.
CareSource employees will spread out to libraries and social service agencies across Ohio in the coming months, aiming to enroll 50 to 150,000 new customers. Brian Loy with insurance provider Humana says they're working with YMCAs on education efforts.
Words like premiums and deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums and co-payments and co-insurance, we're going to great lengths to make sure folks understand what it is that they're purchasing or considering to purchase.
There's a demand for education. A recent Bloomberg poll said the majority of Americans think the law will affect them, but almost half say they don't know enough to decide if that effect will be good or bad. But there's another reason for insurance companies to get out in the field. They stand to gain paying customers by the tens of thousands. So while companies let people know about the law, they're also plugging their own insurance plans. I asked Brian Loy,
do you see a conflict of interest with educating people about the Affordable Care Act overall and kind of promoting a product at the same time?
Well, I think that there are educational needs that individuals are going to have as baseline in order for them to understand how to select products. But the short answer to your question is no.
Okay, we have private insurers doing education. We have the federal navigators, hospitals, community groups, and Obama supporters have been running TV ads since June.
Better coverage and lower costs. That's what Obamacare means for them.
Still, with just a few days to go before the marketplace opens, even the insurers aren't convinced the Obamacare road will be a smooth one. Steve Ringel is also with CareSource.
We expect a lot of confusion in the marketplace around this for a number of years. It's not something that they're going to turn a light switch on and everybody's going to get it.
But Ringel says the hard work will pay off.
We will be ready. The feds will be ready. At least we're knocking on wood that they will be ready.
The Affordable Care Act marketplace is set to open October 1st, and the new health plans for uninsured Americans go into effect next year. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
WYSO wants to help you understand what the insurance marketplace means for you. You can find an online calculator that estimates the price of Obamacare insurance at WYSO.org. And Lewis Wallace will be back on Monday morning to explain some nuts and bolts of the marketplace. That's during Morning Edition right here on WYSO. Joel Pruce is a postdoctoral fellow in human rights studies at the University of Dayton and the conference director for the upcoming Social Practice of Human Rights. By all accounts, it's a global event taking place at UD later this week. I spoke with Joel on campus just a few days ago to get details on the conference.
Well, you know, we've been a year in planning, and it is now upon us. We have over 2 days of programming scheduled. We're kicking off Thursday evening with a reception and a performance by the Dayton Philharmonic Orchestra on campus. For the first time in 40 years, we'll be hosting the DPO, so that's very exciting for the university. And Friday and Saturday are our main days of programming. So Friday we have a whole day of research scheduled. We have dozens, literally dozens, 70 to 80 researchers and scholars coming from around the country, as well as close to a dozen countries around the world. And, you know, everyone from first-year graduate students to, you know, senior faculty members. You know, when we first started to craft the theme for the conference, we got an excellent response. I think our theme is really resonating with everybody. So Friday we'll be featuring that research. Friday night will be our keynote address. We'll be hosting Alex Duvall, who is executive director of the World Peace Foundation, as well as a research professor at Tufts University, and he'll be speaking to us on the future of human rights advocacy. And then Saturday we're hosting these plenary events, these large-scale dialogues where we'll be featuring leaders and decision-makers from global human rights non-governmental organizations, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Doctors Without Borders, Witness, Catholic Relief Services, and others. So that'll bring us through those 2 days.
You mentioned that this was a year in the planning. Let's talk about some of the challenges putting this together.
Sure. Well, you know, on the one hand, the University of Dayton has been doing human rights programming and education for 20 years in a range of different ways, you know, including an undergraduate degree and periodic conferences on topics such as human trafficking, women's rights, immigration, etc. This sort of marks a new phase for UD in focusing on human rights research as well as on human rights advocacy. So this is, you know, the first goal, shall we say, is to sort of put UD on the map, on the scale of these, you know, global NGOs and, you know, cutting edge researchers in human rights. So for many people, this will be their first trip to Dayton, certainly. Many of the scholars and leaders have stopped in from time to time to speak or give lectures. But, you know, convening in this way will be, I think, a first for UD. So that's been, you know, exciting to sort of introduce the university to people.
So let's talk a little bit more about the keynote address on Friday night.
Yeah, thanks. We're really happy to be hosting Alex Duvall to give a talk entitled Human Rights Advocacy, Past, Present, and Future. Professor Duvall has been a very critical yet credible voice in human rights and humanitarian circles for almost 25 years. He has that many years of experience in specifically Eastern Africa, in Ethiopia, Sudan, and Somalia during you know, high points of crisis and war. And he's also been there at the peace table, for instance, most recently, you know, in trying to make peace between North and South Sudan. But he doesn't pull punches. You know, he also says, look, humanitarians, sometimes you need to get out of the way. You know, sometimes you do more harm than good despite your best of intentions. And so he has that great combination of credibility and critique that really captures, you know, the spirit of what we're trying to do here.
You mentioned dialogues on Saturday. Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have essentially four panels going on Saturday with four or five speakers on each. And they're targeted at sort of critical questions that are facing the human rights community today, right? So the first one we're just calling sort of the past, present, and future of human rights advocacy. We're featuring Lewis Bickford of the Ford Foundation, Larry Cox, former executive director of Amnesty International USA, Joe Becker, advocacy director in Children's Rights and Human Rights Watch. And they'll be sort of giving that broad presentation, that broad scope to the human rights movement and where activism is and some of the challenges it faces. We'll secondly be featuring a smaller panel on human rights philanthropy. You know, part of our goal here is to involve foundations because, to be honest and not cynical, foundations have a role to play in programming, a very central role, of course. So having them to be a part of this conversation was one of our imperatives from the beginning. In the afternoon, we'll be hosting a panel on human rights and international development, which essentially looks at ways in which these different kinds of areas and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, address problems related to global poverty, which has been a challenge and a struggle. And finally, in the later portion of the afternoon, we're doing a panel on the role of media and communications technology in human rights advocacy. So, you know, that's something that clearly resonates, we think. You know, it's something that people talk about, certainly, right? Mobile technology, social media, what is the impact of seeing someone suffering on television or on a website, let's say in Syria, right, or in the Sudan or in all of these sort of far-flung places. So we have operations people, you know, people who really do the work of communications for human rights and humanitarian NGOs, you know, on board that afternoon to hash out some of those problems.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you think are some of the ineffective methods taking place that you talked about.
Well, I think the conversations will revolve around some of the following things. For instance, climate change, right? Climate change is a problem that many people in many parts of the world, from small island nations to coastal nations to Canada and Russia, right, big landlocked countries, will all be facing in the, you know, near to intermediate term. Now, whether or not that's a human rights problem is a question, right? So some people might say, well, this is certainly a problem that's going to impact human dignity. How does the human rights community address something like climate change that is not necessarily a traditional human rights question, right? So that's something that people struggle with. I think another theme is this notion of unintended consequences. Human rights and humanitarian actors have the best intentions. I personally have no desire to be cynical or skeptical about that. However, in a complex world, having the best intentions doesn't always work out as you'd like it to. So how do we think about accountability? How do we think about ethics? How do we think about thinking critically about the root causes of human rights violation and anticipating some of those unintended consequences before they occur?
Local partners, you mentioned a lot of global input coming in for this conference. And so let's talk about who locally are your partners on this.
Yeah, certainly. Well, we've reached out not only to people at the with the University of Dayton community. So this speaker series is co-sponsoring the Friday night event, the Center for Social Concern, the Dean's Office. I mean, this has really been an all-hands-on-deck endeavor, as well as sort of a parallel initiative going on campus is called Rights, Rights, and Rights. It's a year-long project on human rights and the arts run by Professor Richard Chenoweth. So Professor Chenoweth has been very useful in that. But reaching beyond the University of Dayton, we've reached out to partners at Wittenberg University, Miami in Oxford, Wright State, certainly. We have folks coming. We have a panel set up that addresses local responses. So we have someone coming from Welcome Dayton. We have someone coming from, I think, the county to address prisoner recidivism rates and all sorts of things to sort of focus on the local context as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely been sort of an all hands on deck from that perspective.
Let's talk a little bit more about what you think needs to happen locally here on the human rights front and what issues people around the Miami Valley are facing or should be looking at.
You know, one thing that I think is useful about using a human rights frame is sort of understanding things that are occurring in a local context, but from a global perspective, right? So, you know, something that Dayton, I think, should be proud of is its Welcome Dayton initiative. You know, it's an attempt to make the city an hospitable place for immigrant populations. A, because it's the right thing to do, in my opinion, and B, because it's good for economic development, it's good for city cohesion, it's, you know, good to know that we as a city can be a magnet to people looking to find a home, you know. So when it comes to things that people in the region should be attuned to, I think certain, you know, immigration policies and immigration reform certainly falls neatly in that category. You know, there's been a bit of a dust-up over the past 3 to 6 months about surveillance and about privacy, things going on nationally and globally, as well as certain developments in Dayton and in the Miami Valley around UAVs, right, unmanned aerial vehicles, and the sort of tensions that exist between wanting to capitalize on that emerging technological sector as perhaps a source of economic development, as well as thinking about, well, what challenges does that technology pose to privacy rights, civil rights, and human rights.
For listeners interested in finding out more details about the conference, how would they do that?
Yeah. Well, you can certainly find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Just search UD Human Rights on either of those platforms. We have a central website, go.udayton.edu/humanrightsconference. I think if you put any combination of those words into a search engine, you'll find us. The Friday evening event, our keynote address featuring Alex Duvall, is free and open to the public. It's at 1700 South Patterson River Campus, the old NCR headquarters. Fridays and Saturdays events, we recommend registering, although we will have on-site registration as well, registering in advance. But we do hope that our programming is broad and accessible, and we hope speaks to people.
And then what comes after the conference?
Yeah, well, you know, as I mentioned, this is sort of a beginning of a new push. So we have the educational component, which we continue to build on here at UD. We have an undergraduate degree in human rights. We are at the beginning of a new phase in focusing on research that will culminate at some point in the establishment of a human rights research center. The university has committed to establishing a research center here. The president, President Dan Curran, will address the conference at lunch on Friday to talk about this commitment in greater detail. So, you know, this conference is a coming out party of sorts to sort of, you know, expose what we do, what we've been doing here at UD for so long, as well as this new push in research and specifically research focused on human rights advocacy.
Joel Proust with the University of Dayton. Thanks for speaking with us.
All right. Thanks so much, Terry.
First Friday is a monthly event during which many downtown Dayton businesses and galleries host art openings. On October 4th, the Grassroots Enrichment and Wellness Center in the Oregon District will host an opening for the photography of Jennifer Clark. The month-long exhibit features photos of local and regional musicians. Kaleidoscope host Juliette Fromholt spoke with Clark about the exhibit and began by asking how she got started photographing musicians.
Well, it actually goes back to Sideshow. As part of your duties when you're going to contribute to that particular show, you have to volunteer. There's no entry fee. No money is involved whatsoever, actually. You do have to donate 4 hours of your time. And I chose what would be the coolest way to use my time. I want to be a roadie for the bands. I'm going to work backstage, meet all the cool bands, and, you know, see what I can see. It'll be really fun. So I did that, and I actually met Todd the Fox, because he was the volunteer coordinator, and he was working really like hand in hand with Jeff Opt, who was running the music. So I got to, you know, see how they do things and get to know them like well right off the bat, just working with them so much. Todd actually had a gig like during the show, like that night he had a set. I had never heard his music before. I hadn't met him before that day, and something about his music just pulled me in. I had never taken a photograph of a musician before in my life, and like, I had just taken to carrying my camera everywhere by that point, so I, like a magnet, got pulled in and said, what is this? This woman is scratching metal against metal, and there's a piece of glass going up and down these guitar strings. I have no idea what's going on, but I like it.
The way you described, you know, that first introduction really to the music scene and to Sideshow and all of that, it sounds like you were already thinking of music in visual terms. Did that click with you pretty quickly? Because one of the things I love about your work is that you capture a lot of the action that is involved with live music.
Now, as I look back through my work over the past several months, I've definitely noticed some themes, some constants. There's definitely strong angles, and usually there's some kind of an emotional component.
You definitely capture a moment in time for each of these musicians. And sometimes I think in a rock show especially, there's so much happening and you've got these singular moments, you know, an expression or one action. How are you determining, you know, what you're going to shoot when you're out at a show?
The way it usually works is, and especially true with someone I don't know or haven't seen too often before, is I take a bit of time to observe and watch how they move and how they express themselves. And that's how I prepare for any kind of movement they might make and what to watch out for as far as like the way their songs ebb and flow. Like I can feel if a song is about to come to a big crescendo or if there's going to be a guitar solo, I can tell that that's coming. And, you know, depending on the guitarist, I can tell if it's going to be crazy or if it's just going to be kind of, you know, an interlude and then he's going to go back to singing. I guess basically just taking a step back and observing the big picture, literally, I guess. helps me to try to find my place in it. And like you said, there is a lot going on, but like picking in, like going in and picking out that sliver, that moment, I guess it just requires being as connected to the performance as the musician is to the audience. And I mean, you have to be in it and you can't be wondering when the waitress is going to return with your drink or, you know, expecting a text message from anyone. You have to just put your phone away and just be in it. And I think that's really what the musicians are asking of us anyway. So, I mean, they're not out there, you know, just to hear themselves. I mean, I do that at home. I can just play my bass in front of my computer. And, you know, there's something to these people that they want to come out there and affect you. What I'm doing by taking those slivers, those moments out of time and showcasing them for others is, you know, showing the audience what they can appreciate. You know, this is what I saw, and I want you to see it because these people are working really hard to affect you.
I know you've had your photos published in association with articles about local musicians in the City Paper and Dayton Daily, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What has that experience been like for you?
It's just been pretty huge. I'm still kind of overwhelmed. Like, I had no idea that when I got my camera years ago that it was going to be capable of, you know, producing, like, you know, you think you buy this camera and you think it's going to take family snapshots. And then you kind of like just twist it around and, you know, make it do and say all these weird, crazy things and sometimes beautiful and poetic things. I'm kind of like humbled, I guess, just, you know, that technology is out there and there's still so much I have to learn to say what I need to say before I can say it. You know, it's been a really, really fun ride and I still want to keep going. Like, I want to see how far I can go with it, I guess.
We're talking to Jennifer Clark. She is going to have an art show. It's her first solo show. It opens next weekend, first Friday, at the Grassroots Enrichment and Wellness Center in the Oregon District. Tell me about putting together this show. Was it hard to pick which pieces you were going to include in the show?
Yes, it was.
How did you make those choices? Was it just pulling out your favorites? Did you have to sort of prioritize, like, oh, I need, you know, this representation of these bands? I mean, was that a consideration as well?
Yes. I went first with my favorites, the ones that tugged at the heart the strongest. And then I decided that I did need to kind of represent the whole body of work. You know, it doesn't have to be an equal representation, but there should be all the different elements. Like, I have a section for guitarists. I have a section for vocalists, and regardless of if that's a singer, like a singer from Playdate. We have one of the pictures here. His name's Rogan. Then we have a couple of hip-hop artists, Dipspit and Dump Truck and Tino. I've got some pictures of them up. And then we also have, I've noticed a couple of interesting patterns. One of them is parents and their children playing music. I've got one of Tim Gabbard and his son Aaron. They came out for Rock and Roll Playdate back in Father's Day earlier this year. It was Tim's birthday as well. So Aaron said, yes, for your birthday and for Father's Day, I will come out and play bass for your set. And I thought that was such a sweet gesture. I also have a picture of a mother-daughter duo, Lindsay Campana and Linda Smith, her mother. They have a band called Fire and Ice.
Do you feel like because of your work, you've sort of, you know, met all of these people and experienced all of these things that you may not have if you were, you know, not on this quest to make art?
I don't think I would have. When you don't have too many people to get involved with and they're not necessarily that artsy or weird, it's going to be hard to get your projects off the ground. And yeah, definitely having this ticket into a bigger community of people that are kind of just up for anything has been really, really beneficial for me. And I feel like actually doing this has improved like my life as someone who appreciates music. But also, I feel like the music has improved my photography.
Now, the show opens next Friday. How long is it going to be up?
They're going to be up for the whole month of October. October 4th, Friday, they're going to be there from 5 to 8 o'clock. That's going to be my artist reception. And then they're going to be up for the rest of the month. So, you know, if you can't make it at that time, please do stop in and say hi to Lisa Patrick Wright while you're at it.
Jen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for listening. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.